show Chilly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chilly.
June 24, 2021, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the thing you were looking for if you're hearing me, because it is the O'Chilly Effect, brought to you from the facilities of O'Chilly.com. Soon to be, relocating from the blanket fort I got to build around me in one location to an actual room. But anyway, we'll get to that next week. In the meantime, it is Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week, because there is no Saturday special this week, but the 2000th episode coming up on Tuesday, so yeah. But meanwhile, I got some good stuff to get to before then. What do I mean by good stuff? Well, unfortunately, we're actually at the end of the books in the Larry Hancock collection. Does that mean this is the last episode? Maybe not. We may have a couple of addendums here, a catch-all, an index of audio, so to speak, might come up, and there might even be another episode. So possibly a couple of appendices to the Larry Hancock collection in podcast form. But this is the last book tonight, and what book is that? It is titled Tipping Point. And I gotta say, it almost seems like it belongs somewhere in the middle if you just read the title. But when you read the book, there's something to it, and it tell you how much there's something to it before we get into, okay, let's introduce the book from scratch here with Larry. I don't write stuff on Amazon. I don't write customer reviews. I don't write book reviews. I've had people ask me. Yeah, well, you know, there is a book review on Amazon for Tipping Point from the host of this show up there. Okay, tells you something, doesn't it? All the JFK books I've read, all the authors I've had on this show, whose book did I put up a review for? And it's, you know, one of these short bullet point type reviews. Yeah, Larry's book, Tipping Point. So that should be enough to tell you I take this book seriously. And I know Larry took it seriously because he takes all of his stuff seriously. I'm wondering if his wife came up with the title for this one as well. And you'll have to listen to previous episodes to know why I'm saying that. But I do want to get deep into this book and really let Larry speak. Now, unfortunately, also, Larry's on the phone tonight, so sound quality, you know, it seems like it's going to be fine. But we don't have the normal sound quality from Larry. And who knows, maybe that'll be an improvement somehow. Usually, I would say on the phone, it's not. But Larry is patiently waiting while I run my mouth here. And I'm ready to go. I hope you are too. And we're going to talk about Tipping Point tonight. So, Larry, first of all, how you doing, sir?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, Chuck. I am amazed that we've kind of made it through this far. You know, so many books, so many conversations, so I'm excited, not excited to have it wrapping up, but I'm excited we made it.
Well, and I think it's a standalone interesting series. You know, I don't know what the various publishers think of this, because there is more than one publisher. Oh, by the by, before we're done tonight, maybe we'll talk about how Unidentified is available through somewhere else other than Amazon. I do put Amazon links out there for books, but I'm not always pleased to do so because I don't like Amazon. It's not because of your book, Larry, but I have a distaste for Amazon. But the fact is, that's one of the best book delivery systems out there. But there may be other ways to get other of your works, actually. So before we're done tonight, maybe we'll tell people where they can get Unidentified. And in a very good, solid form from somebody else. And I don't know, maybe my memory's scrambling things, but they can get signed copies that way, I think, right?
They can get signed copies of some of the books. Mm-hmm. It's a timing thing, basically. Basically, JFK Lancer is the source for some of my books, and Deborah is very good about doing signed copies. Some of the other publishers that go through distribution, it's not quite so easy. And certainly, I'm always willing to sign copies and send them back to folks. But it's, as you said, it's, you know, this has been 30 years in progress to get to the point we are in talking about Tipping Point and a dozen different books and half a dozen different publishers. It's been a journey.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. And the fact that before Tipping Point came out, because now I haven't read the version of Tipping Point that is up for sale on Amazon in paperback and digital, but I have read a version of Tipping Point. And there might be some changes, and I'm not sure what they are, but it's always, look, it's always preferable to me to get the physical book in my hand anyway. I love that. And this one, by the way, when you see it as cover art out there, it's I think it's the only one of your books that has something that looks like a newspaper on it. I'm not sure who's responsible for cover design here, but it does give me that nostalgic kind of throwback feeling for a lot of other JFK books in the past, which is kind of funny because this is really the last thing. And it actually focuses very much on the Kennedy assassination. So we are in the still in the political assassination section before we get to the appendix or the addendum, depending on how you look at it, to Larry's collected works here in podcast form. But it's fascinating to me because it looks like something that could have been released earlier on, cover art wise. But it does stand out because you never did that before with the headline like that. Although I think there was a version of a King book that has a newspaper on it, maybe.
Yes. But it's interesting. You have caught something very interesting about Tipping Point, to me at least, and that was the point that when we sat down to do this, and it being basically the wrap up book. From my perspective on the Kennedy assassination, like after all the other work, it's like, okay, let's focus down and try to deal with exactly how the Dallas conspiracy originated, how it came together, how it happened. A very key element which the book covers, it addresses one of the goals of the conspiracy, which was to focus the attack and on Fidel Castro and link the attack to Castro. And so how do you capture that, and how do you capture that in a book title? Because, as you and I both know, like, how many? There are 300, 400 JFK books. How do you distinguish yourself from that plus capture this Cuban aspect? And I had been familiar, actually, from being in Texas and seeing that particular newspaper headline. I've been familiar with that, and so I came back and said, you know, this is what, if the conspiracy and the goal was what I think it to be and what Tipping Point spells it out to be, this would have been the newspaper headline across the nation. This is what they wanted. This was supposed to be the ultimate goal, directly tying the assassination to Castro via Oswald. The fascinating thing is it wasn't. It's like this paper, this is the headline that came out within hours, yet within a day, that's gone. You don't see that storyline anywhere in the media. And that was a fascinating thing to me, and we really had to work on capturing that. The other thing we capture in the book is, on the book cover, are the remarks from various people in the Kennedy administration itself, from RFK, from other people, that are personal remarks that show you that people knew, absolutely knew, that there was a conspiracy in play. Which, again, made it into the press.
Right. Now, what's interesting here, though, is that visually, yeah, that's what happened. It went in and out of the headlines on the hard copy press, the paper press. But over the course of that weekend, there was a concerted effort to distribute, guess what? His interviews from New Orleans that were played in part or in whole across the country and across the various networks. So, yeah, one newspaper, a couple of editions maybe, had the headlines on it. But the idea that, you know, fair play for Cuba committee, look, he's a communist, look, he's on Castro's side. That stuff went on, you know, and again, it's not the electronic media of today, but on radio, they certainly pushed it out there. And when you study, you know, broadcasts from Cincinnati and, you know, in California and New York, you can hear not only just the networks, but even the local versions of network coverage going, listen, we have a tape of Oswald. He's a communist, basically. and he's pro-Castro. But only over the course of the weekend, and by the time the funeral happens, right, it disappears. Which is odd, but continued on longer than the newspapers. Now, meanwhile, you're trying to capture this in a visual element on the book cover. So I think you succeeded in that, and I'm glad this is where we went, because this was a multifaceted, multimedia effort to put out a story, and then immediately it was totally silenced, which I find really fascinating about it. So please continue on. I just wanted to throw in the audio version that America was inundated with. So go ahead.
And it's kind of interesting, Chuck, and I guess we'll have to reset a little bit, but what we're discussing right now is really the dialogue that comes up in the last dozen or so pages of the book under A Visible Conspiracy and the Castro Linkage. And this is the way I conclude the book, with saying, okay, this was supposed to happen. It didn't. This is kind of the abortive attempt by those involved to force it. It didn't work, and why? So that is, it's really part of the story that often doesn't get told. It gets ignored because everybody talks about, well, okay, there was media control, there was a cover-up, so on and so forth, but they kind of miss the point that there were certain people trying to make this stick in the first 24, 72 hours afterwards, and just doing all sorts of outreach and actually exposing themselves. Because the counter story to that question is, obviously, if somebody comes and tells you, oh, well, we saw Oswald in touch with Castro agents, you know, there are some questions to be asked of them, like, did you not report that to anybody? How do you know? How do you know these people? And nobody ended up asking those questions, but just by making that push, they were exposing themselves. There's a call to Mrs. Luce of the Luce Publishing Network, trying to sway her by people that are claiming to have inside facts, not only on Oswald, but the fact that in advance they knew he could kill the president. Well, turn that around, and, you know, if she takes that to the FBI. The FBI really, you know, you would think that would, it's like, so these people knew he was that dangerous, and they didn't tell us or the secrets, but, you know, it stops. Nobody wants to pursue that aspect of it. So it really is an important part of the story that generally gets neglected.
Well, and nobody at that point knew the James Hostie story, and therefore knew that the FBI was supposed to be monitoring Oswald, right? Although it would have been foolish to not know that, because another thing that went out along with the, hey, he was out there, fair play for Cuba, here's film of him handing out communist literature, here's, you know, or in some places they would say it was pro-Castro literature, you know, which they did indeed have film of him, because they had filmed him in New Orleans doing that the summer before the assassination. But also, it was widely publicly known immediately that he had at one point attempted to defect to the USSR. So now the reverse engineering begins in somebody's mind who has an idea about what's going on here. Well, if you guys knew that he had defected to the USSR unsuccessfully and returned with a Russian wife, which, of course, was the thing that was, oh, boom, out there right away, and he was pro-Castro, and he was actively, you know, out there leafleting for him and going on interviews and doing propaganda, what do you tell it? You didn't know that this guy could potentially be an anti-American threat? Now, I'm not saying I buy any of this. What I'm saying is that if you push that stuff out into the public, you might get a few intelligent people asking those questions. Well, all of this having been known about this guy, what, nobody kept track? Nobody figured maybe we should watch or look out for him somewhere? Or, you know what I mean? Like,
oh,
yeah, that's... Go ahead,
I think one of the more fascinating things, and again, something that most people don't discuss, is well before the assassination, in September and October, because of his activities in New Orleans, there were people making propaganda records about Lee Oswald. They were placing articles in publications. There were Cuban exile groups in Miami writing senators and congressmen about Lee Oswald as being a security threat. You know, he's naive, he's gullible, he's been co-opted by the Castroites. You know, this is really illustrates how dangerous these people are. I don't recall a single person in Congress after the fact saying, oh, well, you know, we had this letter about Lee Oswald, and, you know, I didn't think much about it, but, you know, these people from Miami were even writing me that he was a commie. You know, but you don't. That just faded away too.
Yeah, right.
This whole context just kind of evaporated within a week or so. And there's a reason why it did evaporate, and I try to discuss that in the book. But again, that tipping point really tries to circle around and address some of those elements that aren't just. Yes, it addresses the conspiracy. It addresses the attack, but you've got to look at several different points at the same time to grasp it. You know, what went on immediately afterwards, what stage setting had been done, in any event. So, yeah, that's the reason we went with the cover, to lay the groundwork to expose some of those things that just don't get discussed in most of the JFK books.
Right. So with that in mind, we were talking about something that is covered in detail toward the end of Tipping Point. But let's go to the beginning again, okay? Because, you know, this is what I do in the first hour with these books, Larry, is I jump around a bit, and that's good. And then we get to some, you know, real brass tacks in the second hour. So you obviously had this idea. You've already told us, well, what is it that I can collectively put together and conclude regarding all these years now that I've spent, you know, looking at the research, helping other researchers, obviously looking at a ton of stuff that you never got to write about, or in some cases, looking through things and deciding that you started to write about them, as you've admitted on other shows. I started to write about this, and then I found out that it was not, you know, worthy of putting a book out about it, so discarded it, which is a logical and honest thing to do. I wish some more JFK authors would do that, but anyway, enough of that. Fact is that you wanted to sort of, okay, so sort of what have I learned now? You know, not the old trope of, you know, what have I learned over summer vacation? But what have I learned in the land of JFK research is what I thought the idea of the book was initially. But it doesn't quite seem to start out that way. You know, again, I haven't read it in a little bit now. It's definitely fresher in my memory than someone would have talked was when we discussed that last. Again, it didn't seem to start out that way in the beginning of the book. So let's talk about what the beginning of it was. We know what the purpose is. And where it took you, because it seems to me that every time you begin to work on a subject like this, you start out with an idea and you have to, you obviously have to, edit your way through it, you know, where it's like, well, maybe I had this idea to begin with, but at the end of the day, here's what I've come up with. And, you know, so let's go through the book a little more in order. We went toward the end. Let's go toward the beginning now.
Yeah, and that's exactly what the first section of the book is about. The first section of the book is trying to explain why it's not like all the other JFK books.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I started out 30 years ago, it would have been that way. When I was first working with Anna Marie Walco in Texas, when I was first working with Connie Kritzberg, when I was first... My goal at that point in time was just to write the best, most logical, most structured, most organized JFK book and put all of the regular stuff into it. You know, look at the who shot from where, those kind of details, because I was really so focused on Dealey Plaza and the evidence and basically the classic approach, what you might call the forensics approach. And that was really my goal. That's where I was. I spent years kind of like, how do I put this all together? And kind of the strange part is, after spending those years, that doesn't work. And that's what I review in the first part of Tipping Point, right, is try to get across the point of where that will simply leave you like stuck in the same traps, the same circular discussions, the same arguments that we have been for decades. So it's like, right, you know, we have learned enough by now. We thought we should have learned enough by the HSCA. We certainly have learned enough with the ARB work to know that we can no longer solve this crime or even agree to the basic forensics elements. Was there a hole in the windshield? Was there not a hole in the windshield? Where did those dents in the chrome on the top of the window come from?
Right.
Where did, you know, it just does not work.
Well, how about this? Where exactly was the car at the time of the fatal headshot? You know, that's an argument. Is that X in the right place there on Elm Street? Another argument. And just for the record, Anne-Marie Kunzwalko is a rather underrepresented researcher who did some very solid work and has not, you know, really gone into the digital age as a well-known researcher, but had done a lot of solid work, just for the listener's edification. And Connie Critchberg was a print journalist in Dallas who the day of or day after the assassination, I'm not sure when the article was written, day of or day after, but, you know, very famously had her article edited and the meaning of her reporting changed. And you can certainly find references to her, but these are people that are not often mentioned any longer. But it gives you an idea of the time period when these people were available, speaking to others and stuff like that on a more open basis as to when Larry's talking about a time period here. So I just wanted to put that out there as a reference for the listener and say, yeah, of course, you go through the process. And by the way, something consistent but not repetitive in your writing is I love the way you set these every one of your books is, you know what, first let me give you a, you know, not just an introduction, but an explanation of where it is we're going to go here. And even though I'm giving you a compass, so to speak, doesn't mean we know every stop on the map. So I love that about your writing style, is that you very consciously make it so that, indeed, Larry's collected works, in my estimation, are a self-contained library that all link together. Whether we're talking about the political assassination section or the national security section, they all link together quite well. It's like he made a jigsaw puzzle, one piece at a time, and fit them together. And yet, if you take each piece of the jigsaw puzzle, you could read just one of these books on their own. You could do that because Larry takes the time to make them standalone volumes. So I'm saying that these are beneficial both ways. Sometimes, honestly, when you see the collected works of certain authors in various fields, you know you need all their books in order to really appreciate one of them. Larry's work both ways, just so you know. And Tipping Point, I thought, would be sort of a catharsis. And maybe, you know, when you were talking about writing it, I thought it would be a catharsis. I really thought it was going to be something that wasn't as well structured, honestly. And it was just going to be, look, these are my final thoughts on this. Get it out of here. Which I wouldn't blame you for, you know. But it turns out it's a lot more than that. And as we go further, you know, I want you to describe some of this. Again, I don't think anybody's books that, you know, when you see somebody that says, I have the assassination solved, run. Because you're going to waste your time on some sort of opinion and various leaps of faith. Okay. When Larry lays this out over the course of his collected works, and again, deviates away from the Kennedy assassination and back into it because, again, providing context for these types of actions, right, and going into the King assassination and going back out of it. It's, again, a very interesting thing where I'm telling you, imagine a jigsaw puzzle that contains about 10, 11 pieces. And each piece on its own, if you pull it out of the jigsaw puzzle, has a complete picture and simultaneously fits into a larger portrait. So that's the way it's written, and Tipping Point is not a just one-off kind of like, look, this is what the final stuff I got, you deal with it. Although, maybe I'm not being entirely honest about that. It's not a throwaway book, is what I'm telling you. It's, you know, if you have other of Larry's works, it goes with it. And if you don't have any, you could start with Tipping Point and work your way backwards if you like and put your own version of the jigsaw puzzle together. Okay, Larry, I'm sorry I took a moment, but I wanted to say that because I was, again, I thought maybe because of your exhaustion from dealing with the Kennedy research community, which anybody could get. You might have a tendency to just throw this one out there and say, look, here's a couple of things, and here's my final thoughts on it. Here's my frustrations, and that's that. And again, I wouldn't blame you. And who knows? Maybe that volume comes in the future. But this wasn't so.
That's actually where this started. This really started with enough people having asked me, so what do you really think? That I thought, you know, I'm going to have to answer this. I'm going to write a 20-page monograph. That's the most it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And here's what I think, and we're done. Okay. But that just never happens with me. So I started out doing that and ended up with a book. But what I, back to the trap is, it's easy enough to say, okay, this is what I tried to do, and what I couldn't do, and this is just a trap, because, you know, that's what I learned. And here is why I turned around and went another direction, because that's the second part of Tipping Point, is really like, okay, I found that this wasn't going to work. You would just spend your whole life debating these questions that are important but can't be answered. So what do we do instead? So what do we do instead is we've got to go in another direction, which I've referred to in other books before, is you've got to go to the back door. If you can't go to the evidence, your only other option is to go to people and see if you can find some people that led at least the most minimalist trail to some insight into the actual conspiracy. Examine them, look for context, look for interconnections, correlations, etc. And that's where, when I got to the list, I went, you know, I just can't drop these names and leave them alone, because I've written about some of them before, some of them I have not. We know so much more now about a few of them than we did. Mm-hmm. I just can't throw the names out and leave them. And especially, we had learned so much more about what they had in common. Mm-hmm. Which, quite frankly, was the Cuban experience, the revolutionary experience, the anti-Castro experience, that I had to step back and say, okay, I'm going to give you the names, and now I'm going to give you a new summation of what we've learned about these people. That some of it, stuff we've only learned in the last 2-3 years. Some of it we only learned while I was writing the book In Denial. And that's one of the things about writing all these different books over a period of time. To write a book, you have to educate yourself on a lot and go a lot of places that you might not have anticipated. And most of the places I've gone are not necessarily part of classic, quote-unquote, JFK research, including many of the people. So that's why the book Tipping Point turned out to be something more than just a 20-page monograph of my attitude. And And so a big part of the book is to take these names and give the context of all of these people, including names that people know, like Jack Ruby, Lee Oswald, John Roselli, that everybody talks about, but then relate them to all these other names, many of which JFK just haven't been part of the discussion. And that's what I spend probably a good third of the book doing in terms of what I call basically the Cuban backstory. How do they all connect back to 1958 to 59, and how then are they connecting, including Lee Oswald, Jack Ruby, and John Roselli in 1963? Because the story changes year by year. And as we've talked, I'm afraid a lot of people get things wrong because they say things that were true for one point in time that are no longer true for a later point in time. You can't smear over the chronology. When you're talking about the attack in Dallas, it has to be totally relevant of what was happening during 6 months in 1963. You know, you've got to put it in that historical chronology. So,
right. Now, I'd like
you're,
to...
You're right. The book grew out of something that I hadn't intended.
Well, two things. One, I have a live question, so I'll get to it right away. You know, because you have mentioned, and I'm rewording this, Kevin, just so you know, but I understand where you're coming from, so I'm going to put it in my own terms. There was a time period where, Larry, that a lot of people wanted to tie the Watergate incident to the Kennedy assassination, and they did it in some irresponsible ways, honestly, I mean, in my opinion. This isn't even Kevin's opinion. In my opinion, they tried to tie the Watergate burglary situation. But there is a character that comes up here that that Kevin wants to know about, and that is Frank Sturgis. Do you cover Frank Sturgis in Tipping Point, or do you dismiss him in Tipping Point, or any of that? That is basically Kevin's question.
I covered Frank Sturgis quite early on in my work, because I was really fascinated with him and Interpen and Hemming and some of the characters that they knew, like the anti-Castro exiles or some of their friends like Roy Hargraves, who shows up extensively in Tipping Point. Sturgis is not in Tipping Point, and that doesn't mean that I don't think he knew some things about the conspiracy, same as Jerry Hemming.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that he didn't have some insights. My cut is that he knew what was going on, and he actually was part of what we discussed earlier, Chuck, in trying to plant some of this information. He was very active in Miami in trying to plant the Castro did it information. As a matter of fact, he and his very close friend, John Martino, who is in the book at length, were very active in that part of it.
Right, right.
So I cover him in a way, but not specifically. The reason for that is I actually published an extensive study of Sturgis's career in the revolution, with the Castro part, with the anti-Castro part.
Right.
With his friends, with his, I put that in a CD research with a ton of documents on Sturgis quite a while back, I mean early on in my research, and that's available from JFK Lancer. But to answer that question, here's the best I can answer the question. We, not me, but some researchers, obtained a series of audio tapes in conversations with Sturgis, with his lawyer. And these actually came from his lawyer, and his lawyer sold them to a JFK collector. Okay.
Right.
I've heard those audio tapes. We actually played some of those audio tapes at a JFK Lancer conference. And in the audio tape, Sturgis is talking to his lawyer saying, look, I'm going to say a couple of things to these newspaper people. And we'll see if they can't get them to print an article, and when they print an article, you're going to sue them for slander or libel, and we're going to make some money out of it.
Right.
And this dialogue goes on and on about Sturgis is going to talk to various people, leak information. And the problem with that is that makes Sturgis' own comments and use as a source almost impossible.
Yeah, so, that's the trouble. Like, there's a whole thing with Jack Anderson that I know about, and I've been privy to not these tapes that you're talking about, but to some other tapes that were videotapes, okay, where the same kind of thing is going on here, where he's, like, baiting the media. And I'm satisfied that E. Howard Hunt did a similar thing. I don't want to get too far off on this track, but this is this is good to know. Because, you know, what do people point to regarding Sturgis a lot of times? Well, he said this to the NYC detective, whatever his name was. And, you know, and he said this over the years, and he said that over the years. And I'm sorry, when you got a guy basically admitting that he's kind of creating a trap for a legal situation on tape, and in more than one place admitting that, you know, his stories are not 100% gospel, You got to take him at his word that you got to question it. I mean, you got to question it anyway, but you really got to question it. So I think that's fair enough. You covered him earlier, and he's not in Tipping Point so much. So we'll leave it at that. There's another comment here, which is not quite a question, but I'm going to relate it to you anyway, just see what you have to say about it. In my chat room, he calls himself Citizen GX, but anyway. I know who he is. I wish a credible researcher like Larry would interview A.C. Delsa before he passes. So, I don't know if you have any comment about that.
I'm happy to do interviews. I don't have any contact with him. If somebody can pass them. Actually, I will say that this summer, Stu and I intend to do another, or are going to try to do another series of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Stu has volunteered to help with that. Actually, Stu's a better interviewer than I am, but I would be happy to do that. That name wasn't on the list, and I don't have a contact. But if somebody wanted to send me an email, give me a contact, give me a lead on them, we're happy to do that. Just because I did write Tipping Point and because I don't plan another book, it doesn't mean that I've totally left the playing field.
No, I understand.
My email, I'm happy to share my... Well, I'll share my email, but larryjoe@westok.net. As Chuck knows, since I had a computer crash, I'm not on email not as nearly as often as I usually am and won't be for a few weeks.
No, but you'll be back on it, and by the time you are, so that's larryjoe@westok.com?
Net,
actually. Sorry. See, I've had your email contact for years, I used to have one, I think, that said Uncle Larry, but anyway, that was a while ago, and I don't have that email address anymore myself. Okay, so larryjoe@westok.net. Anyhow, one other thing I want to throw in here before you go further is that I was sitting here trying to not laugh when you were talking about something here and why. Because the one ridiculous thing that you get when somebody invites you to speak or to answer questions about the Kennedy assassination is almost inevitably every show host, TV, radio, podcast, you know, guy that's recording it for his girlfriend and his two buddies, it doesn't matter. What do they all say to you? They all do. I'm probably the only guy to ever have extended conversations with you, Larry, who didn't turn around and say something to you like, "All right, look, before we go on, tell me, Larry, who did it? Tell me, solve it. Solve it now. What's your solution?" They always do this to us, and it's like, look, you know, the complex answer to that question is going to come up during your discussion. So I'm not giving it to you before we go on air. That's my response. And it's like, you know, it's an open question. If it was done, it would be done. There wouldn't be a need for all this work still going on. It's not a done deal in my estimation that anybody has absolutely laid it out. Here's, you know, the parties. Here's exactly how it went down. Here's I mean, we know how the cover-up worked. But then again, there may be more of that that's not known still. But the exactness of it, where you can go A, B, C, D, is not there. But you're going to get asked anyway.
Anything about that question is they do it regardless of how much time there is. I have had radio stations in New York City, Washington, D.C., put me in a 15-second time slot about the assassination, and that was their question. And it's like the temptation is so great to say, Fred Smith, and here's his address. You know, it's like, what did you guys want? 15 seconds, and you want me to answer that question?
Well, 15 seconds, 15 minutes, hell, Larry, 15 hours. I can't answer that because there's too much. There's too many possibilities, and look, you know, the purpose of a cover-up, in this case, in my mind, is to give us so many options. You know, I think that we have been fed some options by people who are either opportunists or working for the conspiracy, whether they knew it or not, because there's a lot going on, okay? And they do, but they do that all the time. Okay, so with the last 5 minutes of the show, right, tell us, who did it, you know? Guys, come on. I can't. But I'm probably the only person that you have ever, like, had an interview with about the assassination in a serious way who doesn't do that to you, because I know what it's like.
Nobody can resist it. It's you're right. It's like, you can't. Yeah, they have to do it. Yeah. Like okay. Eating chocolate. I don't know.
Okay. And the funny thing is, I think you sent me the initial thing that would have been this monograph probably like a year and a half ago. You sent it to me, and I looked at it, and I said, well, this is interesting, and I didn't make any comment to you. I just held on to it, and I was like, well, you know, there's probably going to be more here, because I know Larry. There's got to be more than this, and I'm going to wait to, you know, comment about it until you're done publishing it, because it would be unfair. But you sent it to me before you put it out anywhere. And next thing I know is, oh, by the way, it's a book. And I went, okay. That actually makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, I honestly thought I could tell you something like, Larry, print me a copy of this and mail it to me, because it'll only cost you, you know, a couple of sheets of paper and whatever. I'll send you $5, you know, so you can mail it or whatever. I figured it was the kind of thing that I could get a special monograph of from you. But then it became tipping point. So moving forward, though, because now we've talked about the beginning of the book, we talked about the ending of the book. What would you say if you had to, you know, explain to somebody? Because, again, I know some of the people listening to this show have some of your other books, but some of them don't. So here's the thing. What is the meat of this particular book, which, again, is the culmination of, but not the, you know, not the, like, last will and testament regarding your career in the Kennedy assassination research community. What would you say the meat of the book is for somebody who is either familiar or not familiar with your work, both? What do we spend our time doing besides getting to know some people that maybe have not been focused on before? Because that is part of the meat of the book. I know that. But what would you say is generally in between these two bookends that we've already kind of laid out for people?
I think the meat of the book really revolves around Dallas, and that was the whole focus here. It was let's not talk about everything in the world. Let's not talk about the cover-up. Let's not talk about all of these people, you know, let's not talk about what might have happened. Let's specifically focus on the attack in Dallas, and basically with what we know from this backstory of what we've learned about these people that I talk about, how do you reverse engineer that? So basically this is literally a reverse engineering of the attack back to the point of pretty much precise time and date of where the idea originated, who would have been there to put it together, How would they have selected the people to make it happen? And then the three elements. And this is the real trick to me, Chuck, and it seems to me like it's something that we've forgotten over the years. For example, I believe, and I think I prove in the book, that there are three disparate elements involved in what happened inside Dallas. One of them actually has to do with the attack team. I mean, the tactical elements of it. How do you put experienced people into the plaza who know how to conduct a reasonably sophisticated infantry-style ambush and who are expert enough in infiltration and exfiltration to get away with it? They, mm-hmm. There's that military aspect.
Right.
But then there is also two different elements. And the element is, how do you make that work in Dallas? How do you... Because this team, unless... I don't care where the team comes from, nobody goes in and does that kind of attack successfully without some field-level intelligence, without some ground-level support. You need... It's not like the movies. It's not like the assassination movies where somebody shows up in town with a rifle that he assembles in his hotel room, screws it all together, goes to the window and shoots somebody, and then puts it back in a suitcase and flies away. That's not what happened, and
right.
That's not reality.
Right.
And so what Tipping Point really ties what happened on the ground with Jack Ruby, with some Dallas police officers, with some other people that could be utilized in Dallas. How would that happen? And it ties it together with this attack team. And then it ties in the third element, which is Lee Oswald in 1963. Not Lee Oswald in 1959, Lee Oswald in 1963. Who really knew about him operationally, and who would have been in a position to essentially walk him into the frame? And when I say walk him into the frame, you got to connect the dots from New Orleans to Houston, Texas, to Dallas, Texas, and into the school book depository.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I say that, it's kind of like, well, how can you say that's the meat of it? Because we've all talked about those things before. But from my perspective, the meat of it is not just speculating about all those things. It's literally tying them together to a group of two or three people that could have made it work together.
Well, now here's what the problem is, right? And I want to oversimplify this for a moment. If we can agree that, you know, let's try and bring the researchers in the JFK conspiracy advocacy community together for a moment. If we can agree that Lee Harvey Oswald is not solely responsible for the assassination, right? And we can agree that he was present in the circumstances immediately surrounding the assassination. If we can agree on those two things, now we have to get to, well, was he coincidentally present? Or was he maneuvered into position, either to allow him to participate or to just take the fall? Doesn't matter. Because he had to have been maneuvered to be in position, to be in proximity. Then he becomes the fall guy one way or another. And that does not seem to have been done accidentally, coincidentally. So now you have, how could he be maneuvered? Who could do that? And who could position all this stuff in advance to make sure that this circumstance emerged? And it's difficult because, okay, let's just go with the theorem, the general theorem. Okay, the intelligence community, CIA. Well, they have people that could do that and would do that, no problem. You go to a military, well, you do need some military discipline here in this circumstance in order to pull certain things off, which, by the way, does not discount your criminal elements, because on a certain level, even organized crime utilizes intelligence. They got to know where somebody's going to be and when, if they're going to go kill them. So the bare basic intelligence is in play, even if you wanted to go with the mob theorem. Okay, if you wanted to go with the localized police and law enforcement conspiratorial cross-section, you still have some military element here in behavior. And there is nothing saying that a small cross-section of particular players that could have cooperated, because there's overlap on all of this. You can find connections from intelligence community to crime. You can find connections from crime to law enforcement, from law enforcement to intelligence. You can find, you know, in other words, they're all overlapping one way or another. And if you can come up with, ready, a nexus, it is possible to bring in multiple elements, not involve a whole lot of people because you don't need a huge team, but a small team that could be at the nexus of connectability between all or some of these particular theorem elements, right? So it's kind of a tough job to boil it down to that question that everybody likes. So who's really responsible? And it kills me. Because, again, you could have a guy who's a criminal but also a useful asset to the agency. Could have been former military. Could be familiar with military people. Could be that they're all tied together through the local Dallas PD. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with any or all of these theorems, but one of them seems like it has to have had something to do with what went on here. And, look, I'm trying to be as general as possible and not spoil the information in the book, right? But the meat of it, you got to first exhaust the Oswald situation. Admitting that he's there, admitting that he took the fall, admitting that there are some elements here that just don't seem to be accidental. And therefore, if you have, you know, the conscious efforts of an organization or a group of people that can be demonstrated here, well, now we need to find who they are. Does that make any sense to you, what I just ran through? I mean, really? Is this also...
It does, because I could go back in time to when I wrote Someone Would Have Talked, mm-hmm. 2006, 2010, and say, all right, here's a scenario. We can speculate about this. This is logical, you know, and involving these elements and people from these elements, and this is a reasonable scenario, because mm-hmm. it looks like this. But what we could not do, that I think we can do now, is actually do names. Mm-hmm. And we can't do, you know, just, we can do a list of names that says, okay, these are the people in the places that could have made this happen, and quite frankly, people have said it was them. And in some instances, they've admitted personally that it was them. And so... if you take some of their own statements, you know, let's go with this, and let's boil it down to people and places and movements. Mm-hmm. And one of my big objections at this point in time, because of what we've learned, is we shouldn't be speculating at a high level anymore. I mean, it's not that we can't be, but I think you've got to call in your cards and say, if you want to come up with a new theory or a new scenario or whatever, you've got to tie it to Dallas. You just can't say, this could have happened, and, you know, you've got to be able to connect the dots very specifically to movements of people, to activities in Dallas, to make sense out of it. It's got to be at the level of reverse engineering. If you can't tie it directly to people, to travel, to people that were known to be in Dallas, to people that were known to be using Lee Oswald and associated with him, then you're not up to date, because we can do that. That's what I do in Tipping Point. So that's the stage we should be at now, from my point of view.
Mm. So one more live question, and then I guess we'll pivot to the next hour, because a whole hour's gone by now. and I'd like to get into some of those names. Not all of them, but some of them, and you know, get you to give us a thumbnail sketch of the whole book, basically. before we're done in the next hour. But before we get there, there is one more interesting question from a live listener, and I don't remember your first name, but I do know you as the Panda Guy on Skype. And I know you're a guy. I can't remember your name, dude, so you'll have to shoot it to me. Sorry. But he asks if David Atlee Phillips is covered in your book, and if so, why? Which I know why he's asking this question. Let me just qualify it really quickly for you, Larry. This is a guy who has been convinced over the years several times because of conversations that he's had with me in text form that, you know, David Atlee Phillips is... Well, you know, is the Maurice Bishop character, you know, and this kind of thing. Okay.
Well, first to answer the question, looking at the index at the back of Tipping Point, says he's mentioned on 14 different pages.
Ah.
So I guess the answer to that first part would be yes, mm-hmm. He is mentioned. He's mentioned in conjunction with Oswald because I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that Phillips was not being consulted in the propaganda campaign that was being set up against Oswald. He was probably being consulted in the counterintelligence campaign that was set up around Oswald. That is the reason that he went back to not only to Langley, but most specifically the reason why he went to Miami in October to meet with the SAS people, Special Affairs Staff people in Miami, because they were really using him as a consultant with programs that they had in place with Oswald. And from that point of view, knowing that Phillips had been doing counterintelligence against the Mexico City embassies of the Cubans and the Russians, but primarily the Cubans, Phillips becomes a very important resource. And he's still the guy. Mexico City is confusing, especially for one reason, because there is a Mexico City station operation going on with the CIA station there that's part of the embassy. But JM Wave also has its own separate base in Mexico City where they send Cuban counterintelligence people, the AMETs, which is routinely visited by David Phillips. So there are really two CIA operations going on in Mexico City. One is the classic CIA station thing, and the other is some special projects that JM Wave and the Special Affairs Staff have going on. And those, I feel, include Lee Oswald, and we can take that into some names. But
right.
The interesting thing that I'll add, just to try to fully answer his question, I also discussed David Phillips, because one of the big issues relates to what you and I discussed earlier, in that Phillips is a propaganda pro.
Right.
And if Phillips had been, Phillips would have been able to come up with, or should have come up with, the kind of detailed information to frame Lee Oswald that we don't see after the fact. In fact, it is the missing part of the equation. It should have involved names of Castro G2 agents. Mm-hmm. It should have recorded recordings, meetings, surveillance. He was in the position to fake all of that, to really fully and totally frame Oswald. Instead, what we see is one of the most stupid, quote-unquote, frames in the world, where we bring somebody in that Phillips himself knows quite well, who's a Nicaraguan agent, who says that he's seen Lee Oswald take money from a red-headed Cuban and another girl in a public area of the Cuban embassy, and specifically he's heard them talking about taking that money to kill Kennedy, and even exchange that says, you know, you don't have the nerve to do that, I can do that. Mm-hmm. This is not classic David Phillips. So there's a lot going on with this relating to Phillips that's important, but it's also an issue, because if Phillips was involved with the professionalism that he should have had, we should have had a frame that stuck. So one of the big questions is, either did he not do that, was he not involved, or did something go dramatically wrong and that stuff didn't get put into play? still an outstanding question. But
right, right.
What we see after the fact is nowhere near what Phillips' skills levels were.
Well, and here's another important point as we go to break here that that I'd like you to answer my question, if you don't mind, for a second about Phillips in this circumstance. If we are to understand the operation regarding the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and the counterintelligence aspects of that, combine it with the fact that Oswald does at some point allegedly visit Mexico City and the Cuban consulate as well as the Russian consulate slash embassy, whatever. The compounds are, you know, together. They are two separate things, but all of this having happened, it is unreasonable to assume that that Phillips would not have been at the minimal aware of Oswald, some of his activities, and his interactions, just given the circumstances. So the idea that he met with him and all this, okay, there may be questions, but the idea that he wasn't aware or possibly trying to utilize Oswald or the legend of Oswald one way or another to accomplish certain propaganda goals, that's unreasonable to assert, in my mind. The idea that Phillips had nothing to do with Oswald at all, no good.
Oh, but, absolutely. Totally agree. In fact, a matter of fact, we can talk about this in the book. I lay out four different projects that I think were revolving around Oswald's identity and his legend, as you said. Phillips would have been at least two to three of them, at least. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he was totally aware of Lee Oswald. I mean, not only was he aware of Lee Oswald, he was aware of projects going on with Lee Oswald.
Exactly.
So, and he lied about that. And when we come back to the end, we're also left with his final remark on the assassination. And his final personal remark to an HSCA staffer was, yeah, there was a conspiracy that involved CIA officers. You know, I finally would believe him.
Yeah, in that case I would. But in all cases, maybe not so much. Meanwhile, we are discussing Tipping Point with author Larry Hancock, and this is one of the last episodes, likely, in the Larry Hancock Collection series. But we've got one more hour to go, and we're going to get into specifics in the next hour, so stick around. The Ocelli Effect returns after this.
Ocelli.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started.
WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools?
Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia,
by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
The second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now here at Ocelli.com, but you could be listening at another time and in another place and probably catching it further on down the stream via your Fondle Slab of choice, your applicable application, and indeed, your podcatcher du jour. So anyway, I am having this discussion with Larry Hancock regarding Tipping Point, which I do intend to send out to the AM and FM stations this weekend. So, once again, I want to remind you that on June 29th, beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, I'm going to be doing a special broadcast, which will be 6 hours in length, and it is for the 2000th Ocelli Effect. Okay? So, 2,000 of these shows over the course of a time since 2013, here we are. It's going to be an extra long live thing, and you'll be able to hear it directly at Ocelli.com, at RealLibertyMedia.com, and over on the Post Truth World Hub as well. Post Truth World Media Hub, excuse me, live. And I hope that you will join me beginning at 6 p.m. Eastern, going all the way to midnight. Many guests, interesting stuff happening. Everybody from J.P. Satilli and Freeman Fly to Maria Heller to James Corbett, and some surprises along the way. William Ramsey, I mean, a bunch of people. I did not invite Larry Hancock. And the only reason was because, look, if you want to hear about Larry Hancock, we got the series already. And I got to tell you, I almost feel bad asking him to come on so many times. Larry has done so many of these shows with me. He's saying 2,000. What are 1,000 of those mine? No, they're not. But there is a significant number. If you go back and look in the archives at Ocelli.com, you'll find the JFK 101 series. You'll find Larry on a lot of shows related to his books and other topics. Everything from the Kennedy assassination to the alleged insurrection on January 6th, the event in D.C., that is. Sometimes with Stu Wexler, sometimes with Carmine, sometimes just me and Larry. But there's a lot of different stuff that I've done with Larry over the years, and I'm extremely proud to have done all that. But this very centralized series on the collective works of Larry Hancock, today, essentially ending with Tipping Point, but we may do an episode or two after. So if you're hearing me on the AMs or FMs out there, if you're hearing me in rebroadcast form or you're catching the podcast, doesn't matter, you might want to show up live on the 29th of June. 6 p.m. Eastern Time, it begins. Anyway, sorry, Larry, had to do a little promo for myself. But want to go back into Tipping Point here, which is the purpose of tonight's show. And again, you know, we kind of concluded the hour talking about David Phillips, his relation to the Oswald case. And as I said to you during the break, a lot of people have ignored things like what really happened with Jack Ruby and, well, a ton of other things, because they've convinced themselves one way or another that Oswald is innocent. Now, I am not one of these people who's, you know, a conspiracy of one on Oswald. But at the same time, I don't believe that stating that I don't think he was acting alone and the guy who actually did the shooting completely divorces him from any responsibility. And clearly, he's the guy who took the fall for it, so whether it is by happenstance, which I don't believe for a second, or by design, he was brought in there, you can't disqualify him from some level of involvement. So it's still important about Jack Ruby. It's still important about Phillips, and Phillips being the disinformation guy that he was, and a lot of these characters who have made statements about the assassination over the years, gotta take many grains of salt to deal with anybody from E. Howard Hunt to Mr. Sturgis, who we talked about in the first hour briefly, to, you know, a lot of names you don't even know, and, well, some others that you kind of know. It's not all about their statements, but it is about a collection of evidence. So let's return to the David Phillips part of the scenario and get through the rest of Tipping Point, where I'm going to sit back a little bit and let you take us through that meat of the middle of the book a little more, because, well, unfortunately, regardless of what his true role in the assassination scenario is, Lee Harvey Oswald, unfortunately, must be mentioned and studied and understood in order to begin to see who might have found him useful one way or another. I that's the best way I can put it, Larry. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the questions. I know back again in 2010, let's go back a decade, that was one of the key questions in my mind. It's sort of like, when did Lee Oswald come on the radar of the Dallas conspiracy? Let's not talk about when he came onto the Naval Intelligence Radar, the CIA's radar, the Soviet divisions, the Domestic Intelligence Division. We can go on and on about how Lee Oswald was on the radar. But if we're going to get focused, when does he become viable in terms of how we finally see him in Dallas? And, of course, how we finally see him in Dallas is what's on that newspaper that is on the cover of Tipping Point. He is a pro-Castroite. It has nothing to do with, you know. So if the key element for Lee Oswald is going to be as a tool to tie in Castro and frame Cuba in the Kennedy assassination, where does that really occur? And who's involved with that visibility? Who would know? Who would know about Oswald? How could that, essentially what you want to call a legend, be hijacked into the Dallas conspiracy? Well, Chuck, you want to say something, Chuck?
Well, the only thing I was going to place there is a quick question of my own about the legend, because there are people that see inconsistencies in the legend of Oswald going back a few years before the assassination. Of course, you can't go back too far because time of his death, he's 24 years old. So, you know, doesn't have a long time to build his legend and his legacy. But you got to go a few years back. And one might argue that that legend might not have been specifically designed to deal with to be part of the assassination, but might have been just, you know, an off-the-shelf something that could be useful in a couple of scenarios, which makes the job of tying somebody creating that legend to the assassination a little more difficult. Because let's just say that, imagine for a moment, military intelligence and the CIA. Okay, so military intelligence, you could say that Oswald has an entry-level position there because Office of Naval Intelligence is tied to the U-2, this and that. Military, okay. It doesn't mean that the CIA couldn't later pick up the legend that was being built for one reason or another by the ONI. Or how about this? Vice versa. And so it's a little difficult to parse this out because we can see the legend. We can see a lot of the misconceptions. For instance, his membership in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. People that get us far enough to hear about that don't always know that that's not legit at all. And that there was an active operation that might have had somebody like him creating stuff like that to be disruptive and to attract others who might be like-minded so that they could in turn be tracked, right?
And where I pick that up in Tipping Point is a very obvious place. And I pick it up because there's such an obvious transition. Lee Oswald in 1962, after his return from Russia, is contacted by CIA Domestic Operations Division through George DeMorenshiel. That's clear. DeMorenshiel admitted to that. We know the officer named Moore in Dallas. This story is quite clear.
Right.
And Oswald is actually assisted financially to create a manuscript. Now, you can argue that the manuscript is a debrief on his time in Russia, and it is, because he goes into great detail on his observations inside the radio plant, the electronics plant, his observations about Russian military, lots of very useful things that you would get from a source. That's great. It's a great way to, it's a brilliant way to debrief something, somebody at arm's length. However, the manuscript is also extremely useful for propaganda purposes because Lee Oswald says that he no longer trusts the Russians at all. The Soviets are not to be trusted. As a matter of fact, the Soviets are manipulating communist parties around the world to their own nationalistic means, and this is revolting because at heart, if he just thinks that's a terrible thing that they're doing, that's as bad as anybody could be doing. And by the way, you can't trust the communist party at all because they are nothing but tools of this illegitimate Russian or Soviet government, which is, you know, so this is would be a wonderful piece. You take that around, and it becomes a wonderful piece of propaganda to be fed into the machine. Marine learns that Soviets are not to be trusted. Communists are all two-faced. Fascinating thing is that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
What does happen is at the same time, Lee Oswald is told the FBI, who's interviewed him also, that he's more than willing to be a source. If anybody who appears to be subversive contacts him, certainly he will report it to the FBI, and he will tell them about it because he's a patriotic American. Why wouldn't he? He just went to Russia to see what was going on. So the interesting thing is that's immediately followed by him reaching out to the Fair Play Committee while he's still in Dallas, actually starting to demonstrate while he's in Dallas, to do propaganda activities. And that's where I start Oswald out in Tipping Point, because that's where his FPCC legend begins to build. And fascinatingly enough,
right,
this is the same time that the CIA and the FBI have agreed to carry out one of their virtually their only joint counterintelligence operations ever against Cuba, using Fair Play for Cuba members to go to Cuba and collect information inside Cuba.
And okay, now quick point of clarity, though. Isn't this exactly at the same time where Oswald also writes to the American Communist Party? Now, he never joins, legitimately, either organization, but isn't this the same time period that he writes to the American Communists as well?
Yeah. He starts writing to... Well, he starts writing... First of all, he's already said in his thing that he now distrusts the Soviets, but he starts writing for Russian literature, Russian magazines. He starts writing the Socialist Workers' Party, the Communist Party, and within about 3-4 months, he's actually writing to both the Communist Party and the Socialist Workers' Party, saying he's going to be moving back to the East Coast, volunteering his services, and asking the Communist Party if he should go underground. Now, there is no way in the world to rationally interpret that other than the fact that he has volunteered himself to do some sort of activity, what if you want to call it counterintelligence, whatever. He is actively dangling himself.
Right.
Either that or somebody else is writing all those letters. He's a dangle to these prescribed organizations that primarily it's the FBI that's interested in. And then by the time he gets to New Orleans, his interactions, including his debrief of the FBI, make it look like there's a much... If he's connected to somebody, it's to the FBI, because he is knowingly acting as a source to the FBI. That doesn't mean that he is not has not been identified as a tool in this joint FBI-CIA program, which would require him to be an FPCC member, by the way. This program, AmSanta, will only send people that have the right FPCC credentials. Chuck, that's why I build the whole start of Oswald in 1963 is something, really transformative has happened with Oswald. And we know that by the time he gets to New Orleans, he gets to be on the radar screen. If he might already be with his AmSanta program as a possibility, but he now becomes definitely on the radar of Miami Station and of the special affairs staff under Fitzgerald, and becomes known, and that's where I carry on with this story, because you can really lay out a case that he is actually, and in this legend that's going to be built in New Orleans, is going to be used in at least 3 other sanctioned CIA operations, combination of propaganda, counterintelligence, and political action, basically. And that where a decade ago we wondered, who might have known about CIA, Oswald, who might have, how did they find out about, Now we know that these operations were going all on all around Lee Oswald, and it appears that his identity, his Castro-Cuban associations were being taken for propaganda purposes, whether he wanted, they're just literally being taken and used.
Well, and here's the thing. You know, even if the end game in this was not initially the assassination, per se, one could reasonably argue that, you know, a more benign explanation could be that he was part of a surveillance effort. Here are my bona fides as, you know, pro-Castro guy. Here are my bona fides. You know what? I've written to the Communist Party. I mean, not everybody at that time knew how to find the Communist Party, even if they wanted to sympathize with them. Here's my bona fides one way or another. Oh, by the way, I'm also the what do you call himself, the treasurer of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, right? You know, so I am.
It's all those materials that would be used at the Cuban embassy in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Exactly what you're describing there. That whole set of materials, newspaper articles, copies of letters, is presented in the embassy, as you say, as his bona fides. Now, whether or not he personally presented them or not, it doesn't. One of the big problems, actually, is the other thing that's presented in Mexico City mm-hmm. is a copy of his Communist Party membership card.
Right.
And there is no such thing as a Communist Party membership card.
No, despite anyway. Yeah, despite the old trope of card carrying communist, they didn't have cards. So he's literally got something that, and here you go. That almost leads me away from the idea that a guy like Phillips is directly involved in, like, he could have supplied him with much better stuff than a communist card that doesn't actually exist. Okay, I don't want to interrupt you anymore because we need to go through more of this, but I felt some of these things needed to be interjected here because it's very necessary to understand this. And to go through it as you did in Tipping Point, Oswald's not the only feature. And a little later in this conversation, not much because we're almost, you know, down to the last 30 minutes here. But a little later in this conversation, we're going to touch on Jack Ruby. And it's not necessarily an absolute connection between Ruby and Oswald, which a lot of people try to do, and a lot of people have made some interesting arguments for, and even people that have claimed to be witnesses have stated that they had firsthand knowledge of a connection between the two. I have always been skeptical of that on certain levels. But anyway, back to this about Oswald, and let's, you know, eventually we're going to have to talk about Jack Ruby. But not because he's directly connected to Oswald outside of, you know, shooting him in the gut, which was not the most efficient method of execution, which I've, you know, made many comments about over the years. But anyway, some people don't like it when I say that kind of stuff, Larry, because it doesn't tie it up neatly in a bow. Let's continue on, though, with the Oswald story and this landscape before we get to Ruby, though. Go ahead.
I think we can tie the landscape up together pretty tightly in a way that we didn't understand before, and this has become very important to me, and that is that we can go from New Orleans to Miami with a direct connection, because what we find out is that the first individual that Oswald really contacted to insert himself in the anti-Castro milieu in New Orleans was a fellow who operated a language school, a Spanish language school. Oswald goes to him, says he's really interested in the Cuban cause, the exile cause, and wants to learn Spanish, and who should he talk to? You know, like, who are the real activists in Cuba? And he ends up with Carlos Bringuier, who's a good friend of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's important, and it will become important to legend. What is more important is this fellow that's the owner of the language school, Ernesto Rodriguez, is the brother of one of the key special affairs staff, CI officers in Miami, who is charged with two big projects, among others, two big projects. He's doing some counterintelligence work, and some political action work. Mm-hmm. And on his table, one of his charters, and he's using the AMOT station in Mexico City, not the standard state CIA station, not David Phillips' station, but the subsidiary station of J.M. Wade that exists in Mexico City. His charter is to penetrate the Cuban embassy and use a sexual relationship between a secretary there named Duran and a former Cuban State Department official, Carlos Lechuga, who is now at the UN in New York City. And this fellow's name, his name is Emilio Rodriguez. It will be a major coup for him because they are trying to leverage this relationship to turn either Lechuga or most likely his wife. This is kind of an example of some of the real dirty tricks that get played in spy warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But what's important to that is this allows us to put Lee Oswald directly on the radar of not only, you know, projects against the FPCC, projects against, you know, for propaganda purposes, but into a deep CIA operations project, which is involves people at the embassy in Mexico City and Carlos Lechuga at the UN. And in Tipping Point, I point out why those two people are particularly important, because Lechuga will be the key, one of the key contacts to JFK's back-channel negotiations with Castro, which I view as the actual tipping point that forces his assassination.
Mm.
So at this point in time, we can connect the dots to Miami and to CIA officers who are working together, who have knowledge of Oswald, in a way that we could only just speculate about before. So that, to kind of wrap up the importance of Oswald's legend in New Orleans becomes material for everything from propaganda and counterintelligence to political action. And there are the fact that the CIA would, you know, be so deeply embedded in using this legend after the fact, you can just understand why everybody had to start lying through their teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But the other point that I will bring out, just to reassert something we said before, the interesting thing is it's the legend from New Orleans that goes on to November 22nd. Nothing more against Lee Oswald ever goes into, you know, there's no other documents created. It's this legend of being a Castro sympathizer that rides all the way to November 22nd. That's the baseline.
No, fair enough. And this, again, is not necessarily a connection point to some of the things that people have always tried to connect it to. You know, like I noticed that we have not mentioned Wynn Scott here yet, but he would have been in proximity to all this and probably likely aware of what's going on, but maybe not directly involved. Right?
Maybe not even. This was it was compartmentalized to the extent that they were concealing. We know from the documents that we see,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these particular counterintelligence operations were so deep that Winscott may indeed not have known about them.
Mm-hmm.
Phillips would definitely have known about the prospect parts of them. And see, Phillips was the CI guy for the station. But
mm-hmm.
one of the very interesting things is the performance review that is written for Phillips at the end of 1963 is very negative.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the sense that Phillips was doing some things that either he was doing some things that Fitzgerald told him to do from SAS,
mm-hmm.
or from, you get the feeling that he was not pleasing his boss all that much with how things had come down.
Right. And just for clarification, you and I know who Wynn Scott is, but for the listener,
oh, yeah.
in case they don't know, you know, how would you describe Wynn Scott? I would say that he is the Mexico City station chief,
yeah.
but may have had zero awareness of any operational details regarding this other base of operations you're talking about that was dispatched by JM Wave, which again is the, at the time certainly, the largest domestic CIA station in the country, and that would be our country because it's in Florida. So is that fair enough to give people at least a starting point to go look at Winscott?
I think that's fair, and it's also fair to say that Mexico City was also different in the fact that the U.S. ambassador to Mexico City, Thomas Mann, Mann and Scott played a very unusual role. Mann was actually far more involved with the president of Mexico, and Scott and Mann had a relationship in Mexico that was, it's hard to break apart. I do discuss that. Actually, I discuss that in denial more than tipping point. But
okay.
It gets to be really hard to know who's playing games with who and who has more leverage. And I think that's one of the reasons why JM Wave operated its station. We know from firsthand statements that David Morales made lots and lots of trips to Mexico. There would be no reason for that if JM Wave wasn't running activities in Mexico City that the Mexico City station didn't know about. Let's put it that way.
Right. Okay. No, fair enough. But one would say, okay, so what about the pivot point to Jack Ruby here? Because we're in that time period where, again, there's a lot more in Tipping Point than has been discussed here. But this is a fairly good overview. And I think it is necessary to take a look at, okay, why Jack Ruby? How Jack Ruby? How about that? Because, again, most people have defaulted to, well, Jack Ruby was mafia, okay? And already my headache is starting. He wasn't mafia. No, he was Jewish mafia. Oh, my God. All right, look. Relax. Let's get to what's really important about Jack Ruby, because that's not who he was. Was he involved with gangsters? Yes, but you know what? Trying to parse that out, little messy, little problematic, and it's not this simple one-sentence answer. So, Jack Ruby, what do we have to look at here? I mean, is the idea that not only was Jack Ruby having, you know, comfy relationships with, you know, a large amount of the police force in Dallas, relevant. But he may have had comfy relationships with other law enforcement agencies long before 1963. And I think a lot of people miss that in the discussion. And again, tell me about, you know, the greatness of him as a hitman. You don't shoot somebody in the gut like that again. And quite honestly, if you're going to do that, I mean, and you're being helped by, you know, the poor sucker who was there at City Hall, whose responsibility was to kind of be the EMT on the scene. And the fact is that if he hadn't done chest compressions on Oswald, he might have not bled to death. And that's a real thing, by the way. Look it up. So, by all means, Larry, I mean, I don't expect you to counter any of what I said. If something I just said is wrong, by all means, go ahead. But if you wouldn't mind expanding on this and talking about Ruby for a bit, who you do spend some time on in Tipping Point, you know, I'd really appreciate, where would you take this?
Yeah, I think the first question you have to ask is to step back a ways and say, why, not only just why Ruby, because why Ruby is 2 points. It'd be why Jack Ruby is a person, but the second question is why somebody like Jack Ruby. And the thing you need to step back, this is where I step back into a bit of my military, looking at this from the perspective of the attack itself. If you're going to, in the real world, if you accept the scenario that you're going to send a small team of multiple shooters, at least 2 shooters, a couple of support people that they're going to help them get into place, that are going to help them infiltrate and exfiltrate, you're going to send them into some place that's not familiar with them, not unlike the way that you've been sending a team into Cuba to try to associate Castro. the reason that most of those attempts failed is they had to rely on local field support at some level, and in a lot of cases those got compromised in turn beforehand, and so the teams that were sent in were literally lucky to get out with their lives in expedition. So the point is, if you're going to send an assault team into Dallas, you need some local field support. They just don't send them down there in a car and say, show up and do it. You know, that's not the way good ambush. Then you need reconnaissance, you need local resources if at all possible. So you need some local field support. And if you're going to do something like this, you need somebody who knows the security situation, which in Dallas is somebody that knows about the police department, somebody that can find out about what's going to happen in the motorcade, what kind of security is going to happen in the motorcade, who's assigned where, you know, where would I expect assigned police, are there any special unit, you know, what's going on? You need somebody that has sources inside the police department that can find out what's happening and what preparations are made. And you may need some support. It's good to have things like Overwatch, people that are giving you advanced reports on what's happening, or even advanced reports that day, or you may want people after the fact to collect a rifle that's been stashed somewhere and get out, because you're certainly not going to have your team member carry out a rifle. You know, these are elements that I discussed in the book that you would find in any well-planned ambush.
Again, well, and one more thing, too, is that spotters in the event itself. See, just because you know where security's supposed to be doesn't mean that, you know, as the events are unfolding, they move around. So you're going to need a way of having some sort of communication. Hey, listen, we thought that there would be 80 police over here, you know, in this section of the crowd, and it turns out that these guys shifted around and went somewhere else. Now,
it'd be handy to have somebody on a motorcycle on the route that could call you from the assembly point and say, okay, here's how it's really lining up, and yes, we're on schedule, or no, we're not on schedule. You know, absolutely, that kind of, and it doesn't have to be super secret, it just can be somebody in a position to, you know, see what's going on and maybe get over a telephone, not a special radio, but or even after the fact saying, oh, here's what's coming down, we were expecting this to happen and it didn't, kind of like the call that Tippett makes after running into the record store. So yeah,
which is still
exactly
weird. Yeah,
right.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, if you've got cops, say, that are involved, and somebody else is just, their whole job is listening to the police radio, let's say. And then, okay, I'm making a call because it turns out, according to what I can hear on the radio, they were supposed to have 12 cops, they've got 10, you know, riding motorcycles. That changes the equation.
Or let's just say Tippett's call is something simple like, I'm not going to call you unless, you know, you're not going to call me unless something's wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, like, okay. And obviously at the point he makes that telephone call, Oswald's not been caught. It's very easy to say something's going on with Oswald that wasn't in the plan. But yeah, you need those kind of field resources if you want this to be successful. And so you need to know you need to know someone who's a bit dirty, who will work with you, who might know some cops that are willing to take some minor assignments. And Jack Ruby is the perfect person for that in Dallas. It's hard to find a better person. So that's why would you need someone in a field role? It has nothing to do with Oswald. It has to do with making this thing come off as cleanly as possible, helping to provide intelligence, to provide some low-level assets and resources. Doesn't have to have anything to do with Oswald, but why Jack Ruby? And for that, you have to go back to 1959 when Jack Ruby enters the Cuban scene. And Jack Ruby is actually used as an FBI source, mm-hmm. Most likely as an FBI source on what he's involved with, which is both weapon smuggling and the carrying in of money from Las Vegas to get gamblers out of Cuba in jail. And Jack is very deeply involved in Cuban affairs, goes to Cuba, makes multiple trips to Cuba. People know Jack Ruby, and one of the major people that knows Jack Ruby from that point in time is none other than Johnny Roselli. And I present this case in Tipping Point as to why, if you suddenly take a look at Dallas and say, who do we know in Dallas who we can trust that we've used successfully before? And they had used Ruby successfully before. And not only had they used him, but he had proven himself. At the same time, he was being a source for the FBI. He was also helping them get somebody out of Cuba, one of the gamblers out, not them, not the FBI. So this is a guy, I'm always appalled when everybody says, well, you couldn't use Ruby because you can't trust him not to talk. Absolutely. He doesn't talk when he doesn't want to talk because nobody hears this part of the story.
Right.
So,
but he was erratic. I mean, for somebody to say that he wasn't erratic and after his capture didn't make a lot of outlandish statements, which I would attribute to, quite frankly, the cancer he already had probably destroying him. That's part of it. And there may have indeed been something to what Belli, you know, tried to put out there in the trial that, you know, there was some brain damage here. That may have been also the case. I mean, you know, a guy gets knocked around in some scuffles. This can happen, and he certainly was involved in a bunch of them.
Plus, he's walking a tightrope. I mean, he mm-hmm. is. This was never part of the plan. He's been forced into something he doesn't want to do. He understands the risk to his family, and he's walking a tightrope. When does he say the wrong thing to get somebody killed? You know, he's under a huge amount of stress, so when you overlay that with problems that he already has, and he's an emotional person, you know, he says things in custody, which the interesting point is he says things in custody which he shouldn't have said,
mm-hmm.
but beforehand, he really doesn't talk. He doesn't show any sign of being involved in anything really dangerous beforehand. But you're right, a good point. After the fact, he is erratic, but beforehand, until the point where they tell him, you know, you're our guy, you got to go get rid of Oswald because he's going to compromise all of us. Up to that point, he's not bad.
Mm. No, obviously maintaining what it is that he normally does when we've taken a look at his activities, all the way down to going to the Western Union and, you know, wiring a dancer some money. I mean, all of that is, run-of-the-mill for him. It's all normal. Everything's pretty much normal outside of the fact that he closed his clubs, right?
Right.
Everything is normal up to that point, up to the point of the assassination. Everything is Jack Ruby's being Jack Ruby.
Yeah,
you know?
And when he talks to the IRS informant, his buddy thinks and tells him, you know, come down and watch the fireworks. That is not come down because I'm helping the president get killed. This is just, he has some idea something is happening. But Jack is such an easy target for these people that he's been trying to please for all these years, all his friends who were in the casinos in Havana, and now they're in Vegas. They're everything he wants to be. He's always right. wanted to please them and be like them. It's like shooting fish in a barrel to get Jack to cooperate with this. And he needs some money, and there's every sign that he came into some money. But he's not embarrassed about that. One of the things he started to talk about to people about taking vacations, getting a new apartment. He meets with an architect and a planner for a new club. And this is a guy who's deeply in debt to the IRS, and he's supposedly got all these huge labor problems with his club. No, but he's not really hiding any of that. It's just Jack up until that afternoon.
Well, right. And, you know, unknown to many of the people watching the live television coverage of the assassination at the time, and the, you know, the arrest and custody of Oswald, the midnight press conference, all that stuff, remarkable that Ruby shows up on camera several times. He's stalking him, you know, which you can't tell me he just suddenly... See, that's another thing. He suddenly decides to go do this. No. No good. You don't go in the police station following this guy around, acting like a reporter, according to some accounts, literally correcting Henry Wade during a press conference, okay? The Free Cuba Project, no, the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. That is Jack Ruby on there. There's another voice, too. It's not him alone. And I've never been able to identify the other voice. But, I mean, literally, we can document him stalking Oswald. Okay? He's seen several times on television cameras and caught in photographs before this. And, all that culminates on Sunday when he does finally show up and come out of the crowd and do what he does. But there is a lot more to this, and there is a much more logical way to connect him to the circumstances than, quite frankly, most authors spend time doing. As I said, they usually just go, Jack, organized crime, assassination. And I go, not necessarily. You know, there's a lot of possibilities here. And nobody wants to cough it all up, no matter which angle you're coming from. So.
And I think we talked earlier about the fact that there seems to have basically been a somewhat of a poor job in setting up Oswald. Either things were prepared that somehow didn't get introduced, or it wasn't really the kind of polished job that you would expect. I would say one of the only obvious examples of really trying to set up Oswald is the visit to a fellow named McCowan in Houston, who had been a gun runner to Castro, and who was involved with Jack Ruby, who Jack Ruby had contacted before Ruby went to Cuba. And I don't think this was by happen chance. This visit to McCowan, where they actually bring Oswald in, or I think it was Lee Oswald, not somebody impersonating him, and try to buy rifles, and from McCowan, who's a Cuban gunrunner, is one of the few examples of if they had managed to get a rifle. The interesting thing is, if they had managed to get a rifle that could be traced to McCowan, who was a Cuban gunrunner and known friend of Fidel Castro, who Castro had actually visited on a trip to U.S., and insert that rifle into the assassination, they would have brought in both Castro and Jack Ruby. I have had a suspicion that if things had gone along to the plan, Jack might have been set up himself. Because you could have painted a picture of, here's a guy who back in 1959 was trying to do business with Castro. And by the way, you can paint a clear picture that he actually was involved in deals to get jeeps for Castro and weapons. You could have tied both Jack and McCowan to Oswald in this shooting. This headline, I think, on Tipping Point, would have appeared in a lot more papers.
Right. They just were missing a couple of pieces to make it obvious.
Yep.
And maybe that's why the legend was not enough to pull the reality. But anyway, we're down to the last couple of minutes here, and I think we've gone through this fairly succinctly, but I want to give you a couple of minutes to sort of tie a bow on this one. Obviously, Tipping Point is something I recommend. The link to go and purchase the book will be in with the show notes, as well as a link to larry-hancock.com, which is Larry's website, and all of the works of Larry Hancock you could explore through Larry-Hancock.com or Larry-Hancock.com. I don't know what the right way to say it is anymore. But also, a link will be there in the show notes to go and check out not only that, but Larry's blog. And who knows? You might even see a few things written about or even the insertion of one of these shows here or there. And things like that. Plus Larry covers a lot of stuff. And I recommend all of Larry's work. And this is the last book we're going to cover. But in the near future, we may go into some extra about maybe covering the total works in one shot, you know, what is to be taken from it, etc. And we may have another show in mind, too. So there could be two additional addendums to the Larry Hancock collection. But I want to thank you, Larry, for your patience. And despite the fact that your computer crashed, you were on with me tonight on the phone. And can't thank you enough for doing this with me. Sometimes we've gone back over some of the same material that you could have heard in the archives at Ocelli.com. But frankly, I've made an effort here to direct the conversation so that you got a unique look at each of the books that Larry has either authored or co-authored. And I'm pleased with the way this has all turned out. But anything you want to say here, like with a couple of minutes, about Tipping Point that would be a selling point, a takeaway from this conversation? Again, I recommend it enough that I even have something with my name on it with a minor typo, which I will correct in my show notes and reprint in my show notes tonight for this particular discussion. But either way, you don't see me recommend many things on Amazon, but Tipping Point, yeah, I did that. So you know how I feel. Larry, what is the selling point or what is the key thing that you think somebody could take away from this? And once again, I do mean it. You could take one of Larry's books and learn a lot, or you could take them all, put them together, and you will have a mosaic that fits together. But again, you could simply consume one piece of it and learn quite a bit. Each one stands alone and simultaneously is part of a series that needs to be connected together. So, go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I would wrap it up by saying, and this is it's kind of strange because it goes with the title, but the other thing that the book delivers and gives the reader, you know, just my view, is literally the question that we've always asked. What was it that would, at a given point in time, move a certain number of individuals to murder a president? I'm not talking about they disagree with his policies. I'm not talking about they had security concerns about him. They thought when is that decision made, and what makes it? Because in the book, I literally talk about what I feel the tipping point was. What specific action at a given point in time in October 1963, not years before, months before, decades before, what moved this group of people off the edge? What moved them to murder? Mm-hmm. And that, we haven't really discussed motive here. I think there was a very concrete motive. There were a couple of elements in play, but that is covered in Tipping Point, and I think is worth trying to grasp, at least, because just talking about people not liking policies or opposing this or that doesn't lead to an organized sniper attack in Dallas. And mm-hmm. That's what I try to do, is work it into what was that, when was that decision made, when did it occur, and who did what afterwards? Who began traveling? Who began the reconnaissance? Who began the liaison work? How did that all play out in terms of a very discrete chronology during October and November? And there's a section of the book that talks about movements of people that I think help reveal that. So I'd wrap it up with Chuck, because that's about as specific as I can get. I won't say, I said before, I'm not entirely dropping the subject. There is some ongoing research. We may have other papers or kind of like with the Wheaton paper that we publish in the future. So there's, even though I don't anticipate another book at all, research is still ongoing, and other people could do research with this scenario as well, not just me. As I didn't produce it on my own. There have been a dozen other people that have contributed research and thoughts to Tipping Point, and they will be continuing as well, and I'm trying to stimulate that. So Someone may, and actually someone has already exposed points that were not visible to me when we finished this for publication last fall.
Well, as per usual, the work goes on, but we have discussed the complete works of Larry Hancock, and I'll tell you that if you release some of these shorter pieces, well, we could always revisit it and add to the audio collection here if you like, but I guess time will tell. And like I said, we're going to have an overall wrap-up of everything. Perhaps we could discuss motives in one of those hours when we wrap everything up, because I'd love to discuss motives with you. It's one of those things that's always fuzzy. But anyway, the Larry Hancock Collection, once again, we're done with all the books, but there may be two additional episodes coming up. And again, I want to thank Larry Hancock, larry-hancock.com, his website, of course, ocelli.com, my website. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.